We talk a lot about cities here at Blueprint, you may have noticed. And it's hard to talk about the modern city without conjuring somewhat, well, often dystopian visions. Our cities are increasingly difficult places to live. Some teeter on the brink of inhabitability, growing populations, increasing global warming, housing affordability, these things all intersect. But never mind the imperfections. Cities continue to grow at a dramatic rate. Claustrophobic heat islands with depleted infrastructure they may be, but they remain the places where most of us live, maybe even want to live, need to live. So a big question, how do we make them better and more sustainable entities? One man has dedicated much of his professional life to these questions. His name is Dixon Despommiers. He's Emeritus Professor of Microbiology and Public Health at Columbia University. And his newest book is The New City, How to Build Our Sustainable Urban Future. He may have solutions for us. Dixon, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan. Pleasure to be here.
Give us an overview, very broad sweep of the current situation. How the cities that we build and inhabit, how are they failing? How are they contributing to further crises?
The urbanization movement in the world is almost logarithmic. As you look over year after year, more and more, until finally they estimate that in another 10 years, we may have as many as 65 to 70% of the Earth's population living in cities. So you're right. What is the problem if that's the case? Because everybody seems to want to live there. And the answer is that maybe they don't have a choice. Maybe their urban life is a lot nicer and a lot more livable than their rural life that was upset by things like you just mentioned, the climate change, rapid climate change, I should say, crop failures, floods, droughts, of course, civil unrest, lots of other things contribute to the movement of people. So the thing that's wrong with cities in general, and it's a United Nations call on this one, is that although they only occupy 3 to 4% of the landmass of the world, if you put all the cities together, that's how much land they would take up. Mm-hmm. They secrete, I guess it's the best way to put it, about 60% of the world's greenhouse gases.
Yes.
So they're energy hubs. They consume, and they don't really feel obliged to give back, except in the way of a heat shield over them, which lasts too long. And I watch your Open, the Melbourne Open, because I'm a tennis fan, and I can tell you, and you can too, how many times they had to postpone a match because of the heat. Do we know that that's from climate change? And I think it's over the short run, you can't, but I think this has been going on for some time now.
There's something interestingly paradoxical in that the thing you described there of the percentage of the world's surface occupied by cities as against the detrimental effect of those places. If we could sort them out, they are, in fact, a very efficient way of housing the population of this place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot going on that's right. And there's some very unfortunate things that are going on that are not right. And one of them is, of course, the consumption of fossil fuels for the energy that they need in order to survive. Now, you mentioned I'm a parasitologist. You might not have mentioned that.
I'm interested to hear you pronounce the word for one thing. Do tell me.
Well, I used to say I'm a parasitologist. No, I don't study people from Paris. What I do is I study parasites.
Which is a fascinating lens from which to view the city. I'm intrigued how that informs your view.
Indeed. Indeed. I'm not the only one, though, to have done that. Lee Margulis, who was one of the co-founders of the Gaia hypothesis, actually considered people parasitic on the world. And if we had never evolved into what we are and something else that was more compatible with ecological process, the world would be a quite different place. And in fact, even before we discovered how to farm, which was only about 12,000 years ago, The place was basically the same as it was before we even arose out of the plains of East Africa. So we've modified the planet in a very short period of time to accommodate our need to grow. And that's a population problem, which every microbiologist is totally familiar with. And if you streak out bacteria on a petri dish, there's only so much food. And eventually they run out and the colony dies. And if you can imagine the petri dish as the earth and the microbes as us, then that's Lynn Margulis's take on the way she saw us. She's no longer with us, but that was her main thesis.
So where do you think we are on that petri dish currently?
No, I'm not going to go there.
is the petri dish half full or half empty?
The answer to that question, of course, always is yes. It doesn't matter if you're an optimist or a pessimist. The fact is that it continues to fill up.
For many intents and purposes, the city continues to be an effective place to live, and it offers comfort, convenience, and shelter for the people within it. There are obviously exceptions to that and ways in which cities fail, but by and large, they're not at that point of crisis.
That's right.
I mean, you would argue that that crisis inevitably, necessarily will come.
Yes, and in fact, if you look back in history, it's come many times in the past, and especially for the original cities. The cities that were established in the Middle East, for instance, the ones in Egypt survived long, and the ones in Mesopotamia in the area of Iraq and Iran did not. And the reason was very simple. That is, the weather patterns were different for those two places. And the rivers that were the lifeblood of those cities essentially either changed course or dried up in the Mesopotamian area, whereas the Nile continued to flow mostly. Of course, there were times when it didn't. Mm. The populations in the Middle East just kept moving down the river, and all their cities are buried under sand, and they are discovered routinely. Cairo is still there.
So we need to adjust. We need to,
absolutely,
with an increasing sense of urgency, I suspect, begin to transform these cities in which we live. I mean, you have thoughts on where this transformation might begin.
They're not just my thoughts, by the way. It's not fair to put this all on me because this grew out of a course that I taught at Fordham University called Ecology for Designers. And in it, I used the same technique I used for my other book, The Vertical Farm. And I gave part of the course over to the students. And so the vertical farm actually occurred as the result of a letting loose, so to speak, of control and allowing the brain power of a combined, in this case, it was only seven students that started the Vertical Farm book. But the other book was a steady 12 students per year for 7 years. And if you go to the appendix, you can see the names of all of them because they all contributed something to this idea. We all had fun. We all had fun. And as a result, we collectively, with this idea that cities are rapidly changing items, even though the populations may not even be increasing by much, the superstructure of the city itself, is changing according to the advances in technology. So a building that's built in 1900, for instance, you look around for that same building in 2000 and it's not there. Or it's been retrofitted with all the modern conveniences of elevators and air conditioning and heating and all these other things. We change them according to our desire to live into the future. In another 100 years, we can estimate that the turnover rate for buildings takes about 100 years in cities. Mm. So what would you like those buildings to be like? That's the big question.
Well, tell me. The city is, as you say, it's a constantly regenerating ecosystem.
Exactly.
We can interfere in that process to see that it regenerates for good.
We can. And in fact, we have to for the survival of the human species. Then you've got to make these changes. And you have to make them in a way which accommodates our lives and our need for commerce. And those two are in conflict always. And that's where your unsafe drivers come from. And that's where the toxic wastes come from. And that's where profits versus people come from. And not that there's anything wrong with profits, but I think we can live more habitably and still keep those profits. So that's what this book is all about.
Can we talk some examples here of the sort of change we might make? And you've mentioned this already, the vertical farm. What is that? How does that work?
Well, it's easy to talk about that one because it's already working. If you go around the world right now, you can find many examples of vertical farms. And some are in Australia, and most of them are in Japan and China and Singapore and Europe and the United States. So what they are basically are buildings that have been specially fitted out to accommodate the lifestyle of plants. And you might reckon it to a greenhouse. Well, a greenhouse is only one story. If you stack greenhouses on top of each other, however, you have a vertical farm. It's that simple. But the engineering involved in it is not simple. So you have to make allowances for the fact that floors number one through whatever until you get to the top floor will probably be without sunlight. So you need something else to supply the light energy that the plants need to grow. So LED grow lights have revolutionized the way we look at growing plants indoors. And it has allowed for the spread of this idea. They're now cheap. They're tunable so that you can fine-tune them to a specific crop. And you can grow food 24/7, 365. And people are loving the kind of food that are coming out of these buildings. At first they say, ooh, it's artificial, and everything else. Well, I used to say to them, so is farming. The only farmers I know of that were evolved from nature besides us are leafcutter ants. And leafcutter ants have been around for millions of years. We know this from the fossil record and resin and all that stuff. And they don't take more leaves from the tree they live underneath than they need that will not injure the tree.
There's a lesson.
There is a huge lesson. I mean, there are examples in nature that we can apply to cities that will save us from all the treachery of having to rediscover them for ourselves.
The vertical farm idea, I mean, it comes at this the bigger problem from a number of directions. I mean, it creates a more sense of sustainability within a city environment. You're making your own food within the footprint of that place in which you live, but you're also saving the broader ecology of the planet from being converted into farming, which is a considerable problem in its own right.
Indeed. And plus, you're saving water. Indoor farming uses very little water.
Now, water is another of the issues here. I mean,
that's right.
Your reimagined city effectively harvests its water and reuses its water, which is a thing that cities are, as we speak, incredibly poor at doing.
You got it. Although there are some places, very specific places, that are very good at this, and one of them in particular is the island of Bermuda, which lies off the coast of Virginia in the Atlantic Ocean. It's a city of 63 or 64 million people, and they all are dependent upon rainfall for their water. And they have special roofs constructed on their houses, which directs the water that falls on the house to a cistern. And the water in the cistern is then filtered and treated, let's say, with ultraviolet radiation to kill off any microbes that might be there, and stored. And that's what they get. When it doesn't rain, then they still have water to drink. They might have some water to wash with, but they certainly don't go out and waste it washing their car or watering their lawns. They have a big problem, however, because they're built on a coral reef. How do you get rid of your wastewater? Where does it go? And that's another problem that cities face too, all of them. They generate lots of wastewater. We call it wastewater, but that's a horrible term to apply to that. It's water. And so how do you remediate the water back into drinking quality? We can do that now, too. There are whole cities, whole areas of the United States that are now doing that. And it's working out really well because now there won't be ever any water shortages. The water just keeps going around in a big circle.
Which is an interesting thing. I mean, and you apply that potentially to New York's water economy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, which is based on the Roman aqueduct system, back in 20 BC, of functional aqueducts that brought water to Rome from the mountains surrounding Rome. And those aqueducts, by the way, most of them are still working. But it's a hell of a job to engineer them and to maintain them. Well, a lot of them don't need maintenance because they're built out of a very strong material called concrete. So New York City decided to do that, and they built a series of aqueducts that actually brought water from the Catskill region of the United States into New York City, about 125 miles away. That system is still in place. We now have underground tunnels because we can dig, and of course the Romans couldn't do that, but it's an homage to Rome.
The thing that you mentioned of better dealing with, as you say, in quotes, waste water would be a thing that could, there's the potential for New York to just have that circular system to consume as much as it also replenishes the system by.
That's the whole idea. New York consumes an estimated 1.2 billion gallons of water every day. And they throw away, when I say throw away, I mean it. They have 14 treatment plants throughout the city. And all of that water collectively equals about a billion gallons of water. Mm. And they throw it into the Hudson Estuary after they treat it to get rid of the sludge and the offensive smells that come out from untreated sewage. But that's another point to make, of course. Every time it rains in New York, if it rains a lot, we have a combined sewer system. So all of that water goes into the sewage treatment plants, and unfortunately it overflows because they can't accommodate the water in excess. And then raw sewage goes into the estuary, and that's a real no-no.
One of the other big ideas you have is to, and you've mentioned concrete already, which is, of course, one of the fundamental building materials in the modern city.
Yeah.
Your proposal is to reinstate the predominance of wood as a thing from which we build the places we live. How do we work that out, and how do we reconcile that with the idea of deforestation?
Right. Now, the material I'm talking about in my book is called cross-laminated timber. It's not wood as we know it. It's an engineered wood product.
Wonderful stuff.
That was invented. Yeah, exactly. And there's some buildings, I'm sure, in Australia that are made out of that. And there are some buildings throughout the world. And as a matter of fact, Europe has many, many buildings now made out of that material because it was created by a graduate student at Graz University in Vienna. And I hope he's a very rich man now. He worked out a way of taking, let's say, a tree 7 to 10 inches in diameter and turning that into lumber, which is then stacked against each other and glued or nailed either way and into a platform. And then that platform is placed on top of another similar platform in a 90-degree angle to the first one. And you keep doing that until you get up to 5 or 7 layers. And then you glue the whole darn thing together. And then you cut it up into a precise pattern. And you put it together at the building site as though you were putting together a log cabin or a Lincoln log cabin or a Lego set. It goes together like a jigsaw puzzle. And the material is wood, so it's easy to cut. So they have these laser saws now that will cut to any pattern you wish. It has two advantages. One is it's lighter than steel, about 2 times lighter than steel, and at the same time, twice as strong. And being light, it's easy to handle. So it's easy to ship from the place where it's generated to a building site close by or even far away. The other thing, of course, you get is a quick building because one-tenth of the time it would take to construct a similar building out of conventional materials, you can construct a building out of cross-laminated timber. So I'm a huge fan of it. The other thing is, of course, if you don't like that building after a while and you can deconstruct that building and take that building material back to the plant and repurpose it to another building. Try doing that with a concrete, steel, and glass building, and you'll end up with shards all over the ground. Mm. You'll have to melt down the steel beams again, more energy, and the concrete is totally useless to redesign another building with. So you've got so many advantages that, indeed, even the building trade unions in the United States have come to agree that this is the future of construction.
Mm. This is the interesting thing, though, is it not? That the appeal of these things is clear. Their utility is clear. Their benefits, environmentally, socially, economically, are clear. From laminated timber, cross laminated timber, to vertical farming, to the reuse of water, all of these things, and yet, the uptake.
Tell me about it.
Is punishingly slow, and probably. Probably at this point insufficient to save us from the far side of that Petri dish where things run out.
Punishingly slow is a great way to put it, because to change all of the buildings in a city within 100 years, I would say that's pretty fast. Mm. But you don't think of it that way because it's changed gradually over those 100 years, right? But a bunch of billionaires that actually formed a consortium. Bill Gates Jr. is one of those people. I think Jeff Bezos is another. They bought a huge amount of land east of Los Angeles, and they are prepared to build a brand new city from scratch. And they're going to put all their money in it, and they're going to, I don't know how they're going to do it, and I don't know if they've even got a copy of my book. I wish I could go into that meeting and just hand each one of them one. That would speed things up. If you had some model of a city that's already there that does all these things,
right,
to look at and say, oh my God, why the hell aren't we doing this? And that's really all that's missing.
Dixon, thank you. And well, we commend the book to you, dear listener, The New City, How to Build Our Sustainable Urban Future. Check that out. And Dixon Depommier is the author. Dixon, thank you so much.
Jonathan, this was a pleasure.
Dixon Depommier, Emeritus Professor of Microbiology and Public Health at Columbia University. And that book again, The New City, How to Build Our Sustainable Urban Future.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.